When friends get together, they blether. And when these two friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions.
Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues.
We hope that you enjoy listening to our podcast and you could join in our blethers on social media. You can find us at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcast and we'd love it if you could share them with your friends and maybe leave a review on the platform of your choice. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether. Hello and welcome to episode 8 of the third series of Scottish Blethers. I'm Liz Lister.
And I'm Helen Houston.
And it's good to get back together again. You know, it's even in the winter months this year, it's hard to get the two of us back in the one place.
Yes, and it's been busy times, Liz. You've been off round the world, ha ha ha.
I've been getting some sunshine. I've been in Palm Springs. Some people might have seen that I put up a post about a plane I spotted there, a Scottish plane in the far, in the museum, the Air Museum in Palm Springs.
Yes, it was a good post, Liz. And of course, I have travelled east. I've been to Dundee.
Centre of the universe these days, Helen. The words that's on everybody's lips at the moment. Good old Dundee.
Well, that's right. And we've both got connections, family connections with Dundee, Liz. I mean, my parents both came from Dundee, moved to Stirling in the 1940s. And my grandparents were in Dundee. My grandfather ran dairies in Dundee. And you've got Dundee connections as well.
I have indeed. My father came from Dundee. And my grandparents, my great-grandfather, was a carter on the railway. He had a horse and cart. So that was my background on my paternal side, goes back to Dundee. And I think it's fair to say that in our generation, Dundee has really not had the profile that it once had. It is, after all, Scotland's fourth largest city.
Yes, it comes after Edinburgh, Glasgow, and Aberdeen, and it really is. I know when my parents moved from Dundee in mid 1900s, and we used to go back and forward in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. They really did not enjoy going back and forward because it wasn't the town that they grew up in. It had changed dramatically. So I think this episode, Liz, we're going to sort of look at Dundee at its, you're moving into real success.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we'll follow up with a second episode where we look at its decline and its resurgence, because today, any magazine, travel article that you read, it's all about Dundee, the coolest little city in Britain. It's on the pages of The Lonely Planet, The Guardian, The Sunday Times. It's one of the worldwide hot destinations at the moment. So we want to find out about that and why in tourism and guiding, Dundee is certainly the place to be at the moment.
Yes, and we'll set the scene by just saying at one time, Dundee was one of the main towns in Scotland. It goes back, it's marked on the 13th century map, the oldest map in Europe, marked where it is now, on the Firth of Tay. And it was very important. It grew up as a major sort of strategic part of Scotland. Edward I, during the Wars of Independence, he took the castle at Dundee.
Yeah, I think that map that you talked about from the 13th century, it gave him his roadmap of where to go, because he came north during the Wars of Independence. And so it went into decline for a period, but then resurged again. And in particular, because it was located on that Firth of Tay, it was always in the ideal location for trade. Because if you think about it, back in those days, trade was to the east. It was going to Europe, to Scandinavia, the Baltics, even as far down as the Mediterranean. So it was an ideal place, and it became very wealthy as a royal borough trading with Europe.
Yes, and at this time, it was during the time of Charles II, the 1600s, it was very much like other Scottish towns or Scottish areas, very sort of suspicious and worried about witchcraft and things. And one of the main sort of persons or people of Dundee at that time was a Grizzel Jaffrey, and she was convicted of witchcraft and she was burned at the stake. And the story is that her son, who was involved in trade and was sailing back to Dundee, saw the fire as he was sailing up the Firth and said, "What's that?" And he was told, "Oh, that's them burning the witch, and her name is." And he thought, "That's my mother." And he about turned and never brought his ship back into Dundee.
Well, I think that, you know, times of satanic panic, very dark times in Scottish history. But one of the things that they did was to charge the relatives for the burning, for the fuel. So maybe he thought,
"Oh, maybe that was it.
I'm not paying that bill." Yes.
But it's interesting that she's marked, and one of the little tiny narrow streets that runs up from the Seagate to the High Street is Peter Street, and it's got all the beautiful tile work on the floor, on the ground, marking the place that she was burned.
Yeah, really interesting as guides to do walking tours around Dundee. We're so used to doing Edinburgh, but Dundee's got such a rich history. And of course, one of the major events in our history, the Jacobite uprisings. If you listen to the Jacobite songs, the anthems, then a famous character is John Graham of Claverhouse, the Viscount Dundee, the first Viscount of Dundee, known to the Jacobites as Bonnie Dundee, and to his enemies, the Redcoats, he was Bloody Clavers.
Yes, it's funny how you have very different names in Scotland for some people, depending on the side that they were on. But yes, Bonnie Dundee, he raised the standard on the law at Dundee, and that the law is the hill above Dundee. He raised his standard there, and then he unhooked the West Port and let his gang free, for it's up with the bonnets of Bonnie Dundee. The Jacobites raced out of Dundee to do battle at Killiecrankie.
And that was the start of it all, of what would eventually end up in disappointment for the Jacobites on the field at Culloden. But in the meantime, back home in Dundee, it was going from strength to strength. I mean, because it had such an important place on the Firth of Tay, it has a long history of shipbuilding, in particular little small wooden fishing vessels, which then turned to steam power and eventually got iron hulls. So at its time, in the period between 1871 and 1881, just 10 years, it built over 2,000 ships. So that gives you an idea of just how busy the riverside dockyards would have been.
Yes, and if we're talking about the dockyards, I know in episode 2 we're going to go on to the waterfront, but the water as we see it today, you came up much further. Dundee Castle is now actually situated where the High Street is, and that was right on the banks of the water in the 13th century. So the water has receded quite a bit, or there's been a lot of infill, and the docks and the shipping has been part of that.
Yeah, and of course, the most famous ship that's associated with Dundee, the Royal Research Ship Discovery, which was the ship that took Robert Falcon Scott to the Antarctic. And it was built in Dundee at the turn of the century in 1901. And the reason was that by 1900, there were very few shipyards in the UK that still had the capability to build a wooden ship of the size that they needed. And they had already specified that it was essential that this research ship was made of wood, because it was going to be going through the pack ice. And so it needed to not only be very strong, but also very easy to repair. So that was why they turned to Dundee. And of course, there was one other very important reason why it needed to be made of wood. And that was because this was all about surveying. And so they had to have very, very accurate navigation and surveying instruments. And if they had an iron hull or a steel hull, that would completely have mucked up all their instruments. And so it had to be wood.
Yes, and some of the stories that they realised they'd have to make changes when they were sort of kitting out the Discovery, things like mattresses with any metal in them or cushions with metal-backed buttons had to be removed. So it was started out to be looking very comfortable, but they ended up sleeping on horsehair mattresses and no cushions in the wardroom.
Yes, but at least their instruments worked.
At least their instruments that worked.
That was the main thing. And so when we turn in episode two, when we turn to look at the resurgence, the rediscovery of Dundee, that was very much with the return of this research ship as the centre of the burgeoning tourism industry. It came back in 1986 and it's really been all uphill since then. So you can go to the Discovery Centre and actually view it.
Yes, and it's a wonderful visit. And we'll go into it a little bit more in episode two, how it's returned. But it is a wonderful, wonderful visit.
And alongside all this shipbuilding that was going on, the other industry that really blossomed was whaling. You had whaling fleets going out of the city and sailing to the Arctic, coming back with whales, and from the whale, they would boil it down, get the blubber, and then from that they would extract the whale oil. And whale oil was in huge demand because, first of all, it lit up the British cities. This is the days before gas, so they were burning oil in the street lamps. But also, it's said to have lubricated the Industrial Revolution, because with all this grime that was going on to hands and bodies in the factories, they needed soap to wash it off, and that came from the whale oil.
Yes, and other things, the whale, it wasn't just the blubber that was important, the bones, the whale bones. They discovered that they had great strength and great flexibility, so they became used for springs for the horse-drawn carriages. They became the hoops in the large sort of 1800s dresses that the women wore, and probably more important for the women, they became the bones in their corsets that would hold them very tight and very slim and give them these little wasp-like waists.
Yeah, it just shows the contrasts of this era, doesn't it? Yeah. Because you've got the fine fashion of the hoops and the skirts and the corsets. And then on the other side, just imagine the dockyards and the banks of the Firth of Tay, all these fires and the smoke. It must have been absolutely disgusting. And then, of course, we have a professor from the University of Dundee that decides to do a public dissection in 1883.
Yes, and there was a whale and he decided to do this, and they called on everybody to come and see. It was something that was so important that they should see, so they came from all the Airts to see this great dissection, thousands of people coming in to watch.
Yeah, because of course the railways had come by this time in 1883, so they were putting on extra rail journeys to come and view this. And our celebrated poet, the worst ever poet in Scotland, William McGonagall, we've talked about him in one of our previous episodes. He even wrote a poem about it, didn't he?
Yes, and it really shows him to be the worst poem. I'll give you a few lines just to let you hear his skill. In my opinion is that God sent the whale in time of need, no matter what other people may think or what their creed. I know fishermen in general are often very poor, and God in his goodness sent it to drive poverty from their door. So there you go.
And usually they did go on at great length. Oh. But talking about literature, one other association with the whaling industry in Dundee is that it was said to have given Mary Shelley her inspiration to write Frankenstein. Now, I've never read Frankenstein. I don't know if you have, Helen.
No, I haven't. I've just seen the picture of him and decided I didn't want to read it.
I think that's what all of us have seen. But it's supposed to be about an ambitious young man who follows the route of whalers to find new land beyond the North Pole. Now, that might have come about because when she was 14 years old, Mary Shelley stayed with a very, very prestigious family in Dundee, the Baxters. And she stayed with them and their children for 2 years. And so she would have been absolutely at the forefront of watching all the comings and goings of the whaling ships.
Yes, and you know, there were some comings and goings, and it wasn't just whales that the ships were coming in with. There is a story that a Mr. Wood decided that he was going to bring some polar bears to Dundee to kind of brighten up the centre of Dundee.
As you do.
He was going to pitch a tent in near where Commercial Street is now, and he was going to display these polar bears. So they were being transported from the ship that they'd come in on by by cart, and they were in crates, and one of the crates kind of toppled off the cart, and one of the polar bears escaped. And of course, that sent terror into the people in the high street of Dundee at that time, as you can imagine. And the polar bear decided that he didn't really like the street, the window shopping bit. He wanted to go into a shop. So he went into Mr. Jameson's draper's shop. And Mr. Jameson and the one customer that had escaped into the shop both jumped on the counter to try to escape. Well, I don't think they would manage that, to escape from a polar bear on a counter. But eventually the polar bear was tempted back out of the shop by Mr. Wood, who owned him, and he was put back in the crate, and they were then on display as, and this was in the 1870s, it was, you know, during the time of this great resurgence. But there is a wonderful statue now outside, piece of sculpture outside the draper shop, of the polar bear chasing Mr. Jameson.
Yes, another character that you meet on a walk around Dundee. You know, it just gives you a flavour of just how bustling and vibrant the city of Dundee was in the 1800s. And that's largely down to another import. It was the biggest national import of flax. And that was because it was the centre of the linen industry, not just in Scotland, but in the UK. Now, we know from our stories about Andrew Carnegie that the weaving of linen, the weaving of flax to make linen, started in homes with the men, largely, producing the linen on hand looms. But come the Industrial Revolution, that all changed. And Dundee was ideally situated because it had a burn, a river, a stream running right through the settlement. And so it started to move the weaving into steam-powered looms in factories.
Yes, and it's quite interesting when we're talking about that, because if you look at Dundee today, it is situated on a hill. We have the law, the main hill at the top of Dundee, and then everything slopes down to the river. So these burns, the Scouring Burn and the Denham Burn coming down through Dundee, were ideal for powering these factories.
Yeah, so in the 1820s, we begin to get power mills opening up. And one of the foremost of these was the Baxter brothers, this Baxter family that Mary Shelley stayed with. So they became very wealthy over the next 50 years. But as well as a shift in what Dundee would have looked like with all these mills opening up, it was also a shift in culture, because where the men had done the work before in the home, it was now the women and children who were brought into the mills to carry out the work.
Yes, and the women were working in the mills. But one of the things was of the linen was a very coarse linen called Osnaburg. And that was part of our very uncomfortable history, because that Osnaburg linen was then exported in huge amount. Millions of yards of it went out every year to the South America, to the plantations, and it became the clothing for the slaves, for the enslaved people out there. And that was, again, part of the kickstart to Dundee's wealth, with that great trade of Osnaburg.
Yeah, again, it's part of Scotland's history, but these cities in Scotland becoming wealthy on the back of the plantations and the enslaved people. We find about it. And the main port that the Osnaburg linen was taken into was Savannah. And I visited and seen the statues in the harbour. So again, these links with North America and the Scots, very, very strong at this time. And because of the wealth that was being made, it meant that the city could improve itself. It had a purpose-built theatre, and it had a police commission, banks were springing up. So the linen industry really was putting Dundee literally on the map. But the subsidy for linen ran out, and it looked as if, like all the other linen-producing places in the UK, it would decline, but not to Dundee.
No, because Dundee was, again with its trade, was realising that over in the east, in India, there was a plant called jute, which was coarse, but it was fibrous. And if they brought it to Dundee, they could soften it with the whale oil and, you know, use their skills of weaving and weave it into what we call canvas, into sails, into tarpaulins. And that was, again, another kickstart for the wealth of Dundee.
Yeah, and this was a time when jute was really taking off, because jute burlap, canvas. It was needed for the covered wagons. It was needed for sailcloth. Huge demand for it. So again, the population of Dundee soared. And again, it was reliance on women to make it profitable. It became a single industry in a woman's town.
Yes, and at its height, there was 125 mills in Dundee. Now, that is quite extraordinary to think about that, because and 50,000 people, up to 50,000 people working in these mills. And as Liz says, mainly women, and the men stayed at home. The men became the kettle boilers. They stayed at home to boil the kettle, to have the tea ready for the women coming home from the very dusty mills that they were working in. And also the men were minding the wains, looking after the children.
What a social change, eh? How the men must have felt about being resigned to the kitchen at home. And also, if you think about it, this was the time of the Irish potato famine. You know, we had a huge influx of Irish workers coming in to work in these jute mills. And at one time, one in six of Dundee's population was born in Ireland. So the Irish accents that would have been at the fore. So I like to think of the city with its polar bears and all the rest of it. There's Irish, the women doing the work. And of course, with the women working in the mills, this had a huge impact on the policy, the politics of Dundee.
Yes, and women were very, very strong. And you know, one of the politicians that came to Dundee was a young man called Winston Churchill, who decided he was going to fight for one of the seats, one of the Dundee seats. But he'd upset a few people in previous campaigns down in London. One of them was a Mary Maloney, and he had insulted her. He'd, you know, called her names. And so she decided she was going to disrupt any of his rallies. And she did this very simply and very peaceably by ringing a handbell. Every time he opened his mouth to speak, she rang this handbell. Now, it wasn't a nice tinkly one. It was like an old school bell. You'll probably all remember the old school bells. And she just drowned him out at every turn.
It's very tempting, isn't it? I can think of a few politicians I would like to drown out by the ringing of a bell. But this was, you know, Winston Churchill, who had no time for women. He was very insulting about them. He said that women should not vote because they were already well represented by their fathers, brothers and husbands. Well, I don't think that went down well in Dundee, where the women were out working and the fathers, brothers and husbands were in the kitchen at home. So it was at the forefront of the suffragette campaign to try and win rights for women. So again, you know, part of the scene that you would picture of Dundee at this time. But if anybody visits Dundee today, they will be struck by the opposition in the buildings. You know, there are a lot of 60s buildings, which it's very much trying to upgrade at the moment, but also such a range of wonderful Victorian buildings that came about really because of the wealth of the town and the benefactors who had made their wealth, who were happy to show their status and wealth by giving money to the town to be able to build these buildings.
Yes, and these people were known as the Jute Barons. You know, they were so wealthy. And at one time, they, of course, didn't want to live in Dundee itself because of the factories. They moved a couple of miles out to Broughty Ferry. And at one time, there was more millionaires per head of population in Broughty Ferry than there were anywhere else in Europe. So that just, again, emphasises the wealth. But one of the buildings, Liz, that were being built at that time was the McManus Gallery, which is now called the McManus, but was a memorial to Prince Albert, who had recently died, the Albert Memorial. Now, just tying that up with the women and politics, it sits at the top of Reform Street, and Reform Street is named after the Reform Act that was brought about and helped the women get the vote.
Yeah, so I've walked up Reform Street many a time and I've never ever thought of that. Yeah, so that is, again, absolutely bringing that together. Yeah, this was said to be the grandest Albert Memorial built outside London. It really was grand. And again, it was down to this Sir David Baxter, the city's leading philanthropist. He gave the money. They brought in the best in George Gilbert Scott, who was very much into his Gothic architecture. and they got this magnificent Albert Memorial, which still stands today. It's gone through several refurbishments, but you can go in there and see a magnificent display of art and artefacts. So definitely one to have a look at. At one time, it did actually have a fountain outside it as well, but a tree crashed down in 1944 and demolished the fountain. So no fountain today, but certainly well worth a visit to the McManus Gallery.
But what it has sitting outside it is a statue of Queen Victoria. Now, right. Dundee commissioned a statue of Queen Victoria, and it was done. Sadly, the sculptor, he died before it was able to be delivered to Dundee, but he'd finished it. It came up by train to Dundee, and Dundee, sort of the fathers of Dundee thought, we haven't decided where it's going yet, and it is quite big. So it's languished, poor Queen Victoria languished in the railway yards of Dundee for a few weeks until they decided, we'll put her up beside her husband. We'll put her outside the Albert Memorial. And there she stands.
So you don't usually associate Queen Victoria with languishing anywhere. She would not be amused by that. But yeah. And if anybody should wonder why it's now called McManus, after it was erected as a memorial to Albert, the reason was that after one of the refurbishments, the name was given to commemorate one of the Lord Provosts that was seen to have given a lot to Dundee in the 1960s. And that Lord Provost, our Lord Mayor in Scotland, a Lord Mayor is called a Provost. And he was called Maurice McManus. So today he's commemorated in the Art Gallery and Museum. But another fine building of that era was another of these Duke barons, James Caird, who built the Caird Hall.
Yes, and in order to get the space for the Caird Hall, they demolished what was in fact just a rabbit warren of housing, and it was called the Vaults. It was very, very slum-like, so it was a good thing to demolish it. But he built the Caird Hall, which is in a very sort of grand style, almost Russian style. And it is now a big, big concert hall. Well, it was initially a big concert hall.
Yeah, public auditorium. So that's where the count was done for the by-election that Winston Churchill stood in. And it's still going strong today. And importantly, the architect for the town at that time was a man called James Thomson, and he really was a man with vision. We'll come back to him later on in the next episode when we talk about the resurgence of the waterfront now. But he built this huge public auditorium to a classic design. It had Doric columns outside the front of it, and it really was considered to be the bee's knees at the time. And James Caird wanted everything to be the best of the best. So he brought in experts in plaster work, and in particular, he wanted the acoustics to be particularly special. I think there was a bit of rivalry going on with Edinburgh. Edinburgh had installed a tremendous organ into one of their halls, so he made sure that he wanted the best in the Caird Hall. And it's still to this day considered to be one of the best organs in Britain, if not Scotland.
Yes, and people have performed there at the Caird Hall, and it's got this wonderful, what I like about it, Liz, is this wonderful big open space in front of it. So you really, it stands there in all its splendour. We can really see the work of the architect and the wealth of James Caird.
Yep, I mean, the names that have appeared there are fantastic. 1953, Frank Sinatra, old Blue Eyes himself, he was there. But although the auditorium can hold over 2,000 people, there was under 600 people to see Frank Sinatra, and they were appalled. They thought, what on earth has gone wrong here? But of course, most of Frank Sinatra's followers in 1953 were teenagers, and they couldn't afford the price of the tickets. And so they were screaming outside while Frank Blue Eyes was singing inside.
Yeah. Well, good job. The acoustics were good. So, yes, and you know, the city was kind of moving on, because we grew up at school. Everybody knew Dundee, and everybody knew the three J's of Dundee: jute, jam and journalism. And jam was one of the big things, Liz, in Dundee, Mrs. Keeler. And I think you have a wee story about Mrs. Keeler.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of legends about how marmalade first came to be. But marmalade, certainly in Scotland, if not further afield, is synonymous with the Keeler family, James and Janet. Now, they weren't a couple. They were a mother and son. back in the turn of the 19th century in Dundee. They were grocers. They had a shop. And the legend goes that in the 18th century, the late 18th century, there was a cargo of Seville oranges travelling from Seville to the UK. And unfortunately, the ship struck a raging storm and it had to take refuge. And the delay that the storm caused made the oranges go off. They were certainly less than fresh by the time the ship was washed up in Dundee. And legend has it that young James decided that he would buy the oranges for his mother to make into jam. And she did, and it's said in the legend that that was the origin of marmalade. Not so, because marmalade has appeared particularly back in Spain and Portugal, right back to the 15th century, but even in Scotland it appeared in a recipe in 1736. But what she did do was probably it all started from a couple of boxes of oranges. And she added thin strips of orange rind or orange peel to the jam that she was making from the orange. And that was the beginning of the marmalade that we know today, which has the little strips in it. And this peel was thought by people to aid digestion. So it became very popular. And the other big change that she made to it was that instead of it being a jelly, like quince jelly, which is where the name comes from, marmelo is Portuguese for quince. Instead of being a jelly, she turned it to semi-liquid. And that's what we have on our morning toast to this day. We have the morning marmalade, toast and marmalade. The company went on, it went from hand to hand. It was actually the shop that was the biggest part of it. The making of the marmalade was just a sideline in the early days. But bit by bit, it became more important. And when we introduced a sugar tax in Britain, now you'll remember this, Helen, because we talk about William Pitt when we're walking along George Street in Edinburgh, and William Pitt raising taxes on everything. And I talk about the sugar tax. I never really thought about the implications of it. But when he introduced the sugar tax, the Keelers moved out of Scotland and moved to Guernsey outside the British mainland so they didn't have to pay a sugar tax. And when the sugar tax was abolished, instead of coming back to Dundee for their main headquarters, they went to London. So that began to be the decline of the marmalade industry in Dundee. But, and this is where my story comes in, they began to produce confectionery. They were the first company to produce Dundee cake commercially, which is famous today, but also a wide range of confectionery. And my maternal grandmother worked in the Keeler's factory in Dundee, and she put the swirls on the chocolate gingers. So that was her job. Imagine that, day after day, putting all the swirls on the chocolate gingers. And she used to say that in the early days, when you joined the company, they used to say to you, eat as much chocolate as you like. She said, you gorge yourself in the first week, and then after that, you never want to see a chocolate again.
Yes, that's a very good rule that the chocolate factories have, because Cadbury's is the same. Eat as much as you like on the line, but don't even walk out with one in your mouth or one in your pocket, because that is theft. So, no, that's, yes, and the Keeler name still lives in Dundee. The Keeler Centre is in Dundee, it's just off the high street. So it's still, they don't bear a grudge to Dundee.
No, but it got taken over in time by Cross and Blackwell and then by another Scottish name, Robertson's. But even Robertson's disappeared in 2008 because it disappeared in favour of Golden Shred. So no Keeler's marmalade, no Robertson's marmalade today,
yes,
just Golden Shred.
But Mackay's just outside Dundee, they make marmalade and jams in exactly the same way in copper pans. So it still lives, and Dundee marmalade is still a label to look for. And talking about breakfast, Liz, you'd never have jam with breakfast. It would always be marmalade.
Absolutely, I still do. Still do. And the peel aids my digestion. So thank you, Mrs. Keeler. But we'll leave at the end of this episode with Dundee being on a real high. We've talked about the jam, the marmalade made by the Keelers. We've talked about the jute, Jutopolis, this one industry city. And of course, the journalism we've talked about before. So if you want to hear more about that, go back and have a look at our early episode where we talk about comics and DC Thompson, the publishing company from Dundee.
Yes, so that's it, Liz. We'll wind up there and we'll come back with part two of this episode on the episodes on Dundee. So have you got a word?
Right, I'm just coming up with a very simple one, because a person who comes from Dundee is known as a Dundonian. So Dundonian is a good Scottish word.
Right. And as a Dundee, I will just say one of the nice expressions in Dundee is "eh had my eh and a pe." That means you walk into the pie shop, Wallace's pie shop, of course, and you say, eh had my eh and a pe. That means I had my eye on that pie.
And is that an ing-a-ning?
An ing-a-ning and ah.
Uh-huh. You better translate.
Yes. Would you like some, is it an onion one you want as well?
So you can see that the Dundonian accent, the dialect, is a very strong dialect. But as the travel writers are telling us, Dundee is the place to be. So we'll find out why in the next episode.
Okay, Liz. And I'll just say, well, thank you for listening and goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from me. Bye-bye.
Bye.